creators didn't have a grand vision for the invention of an Earth-circling message handling system. But once the first couple of dozen nodes were installed, early users turned the system of linked computers into a personal as well as a professional communications tool. Using the ARPANET as a sophisticated mail system was simply a good hack. In those days, hacking had nothing to do with malicious or destructive behavior. A good hack was a creative or inspired bit of programming. The best hackers were professionals. Meddlesome and malicious network users, of which there were virtually none at the outset, were first referred to as network randoms, or net randoms, or just plain randoms. It would be another decade before hacking was given a bad name. In the decade before the ARPANET, computer scientists had devised ways of exchanging electronic messages within a time-sharing system. Researchers on the same time-sharing system each had a designated file, like an inbox, in the central machine. Colleagues could address short electronic messages to someone else's box, where only the recipient could read them. Messages could be dropped and picked up at any time. It was convenient, given the odd hours people kept. People within a single lab sent parades of one-liners back and forth, as well as longer memoranda and drafts of papers. The first of these programs, called Mailbox, was installed in the early 1960s on the compatible time-sharing system at MIT. Similar mailboxes became a standard feature of almost every time-sharing system built thereafter. In places where people were spread out, programmers working hundreds of yards apart could exchange messages without having to get up from their desks. But often, exchanging messages in a single machine or domain became a superfluous exercise, like two people using walkie-talkies to converse in a one-room cabin. People still got up from their desks and walked down the hall to talk. Said one user, "I'll never forget a colleague who, while working in the next office, would constantly send me email, and it never failed to surprise him when I got up and walked next door to respond to him." By virtue of its geographic reach, the ARPA network changed all that, turning electronic mail from an interesting toy into a useful tool. The tendencies of the ARPANET community ran strongly democratic, with something of an anarchic streak. The ARPANET's earliest users were constantly generating a steady stream of new ideas, tinkering with old ones, pushing, pulling, or prodding their network to do this or that, spawning an atmosphere of creative chaos. The art of computer programming gave them room for endless riffs and variations on any theme. One of the main themes became electronic mail. The first electronic mail delivery engaging two machines was done one day in 1972 by a quiet engineer, Ray Tomlinson, at BBN. Sometime earlier, Tomlinson had written a mail program for Tenex, the BBN-grown operating system that by now was running on most of the ARPANET's PDP-10 machines. The mail program was written in two parts. To send messages, you use a program called Send Message. To receive mail, you use the other part called Read Mail. He hadn't actually intended for the program to be used on the ARPANET. Like other mailbox programs of the day, it was created for time-sharing systems and designed only to handle mail locally, within individual PDP-10s, not across them. But Tomlinson, an inveterate experimenter, decided to take advantage of having two PDP-10 computers set up in the Cambridge office. In fact, they were the same machines BBN was using to connect to the ARPANET. Weeks earlier, Tomlinson had written an experimental file transfer protocol called CopyNet. Now he modified the program so that it could carry a mail message from one machine and drop it into a file on another. When he tried it and sent mail from one PDP-10 to the other, the little hack worked, and even though his mail hadn't actually gone out onto the open network, it had crossed an important historical divide. Tomlinson's CopyNet hack was a breakthrough. Now there was nothing holding email back from crossing the wider net. Although in technical terms Tomlinson's program was trivial, culturally it was revolutionary. Send Message opened the door, said Dave Crocker, the younger brother of Steve Crocker and an email pioneer. It created the first interconnectivity. Then everyone took it from there. But how to get this invention running out on the network? The answer lay in the file transfer protocol. In July 1972, one evening at Tech Square at MIT, as Abe Bouchon was writing the final specifications for the ARPANET file transfer protocol, someone suggested piggybacking Tomlinson's email programs onto the end product. Why not? If electronic messages could write on CopyNet, they might just as well write on the file transfer protocol. Bouchon and others worked out some modifications. In August, when John Postel received an RFC outlining the email feature, he thought to himself, "Now, there's a nice hack." The ARPANET's first electronic mail-handling twins, named MAIL and MLFL, came to life. Tomlinson became well known for Send Message and CopyNet, but he came better known for a brilliant, he called it obvious, decision he made while writing those programs. He needed a way to separate, in the email address, the name of the user from the machine the user was on. How should that be denoted? He wanted a character that would not, under any conceivable circumstances, be found in the user's name. He looked down at the keyboard he was using, a Model 33 teletype, which almost everyone else on the net used too. In addition to the letters and numerals, there were about a dozen punctuation marks. "I got there first, so I got to choose any punctuation I wanted," Tomlinson said. "I chose the at sign." The character also had the advantage of meaning at the designated institution. He had no idea he was creating an icon for the wired world. Stephen Lukasik, a physicist who directed ARPA from 1971 to 1975, was among the first users and great advocates of network mail. His favorite part of ARPA, in fact, was Larry Roberts's Information Processing Techniques office. Lukasik had begun his career in the 1950s, working for BBN and MIT as a graduate student. He joined ARPA in 1966 to work on nuclear test detection, and he had watched the creation of the ARPANET. During his rise to the directorship, Lukasik had fought especially hard to protect the computer science community's funding. ARPA was under pressure to do defense-related work. He saw computing as a more fundamental but important technology, and defended it as such before Congress. But sometimes things went a bit too far. As director, he walked around a lot, dropping in on people in their offices. One day he was in the IPT office when he noticed a folder lying on top of a file cabinet. Its orange cover, not my favorite color, caught his eye. The folder was labeled Computer-Assisted Choreography. It contained progress reports on a project that used dancers' movements to map human motions by computer. "I went ballistic," he said. He could picture the headline, "Pentagon Funds Dance Research." Lukasik told his staff to tell the scientists, "If you're going to do something that looks like it's 40,000 miles away from defense, please leave our name off of it." He understood the research and didn't care if they did it, but didn't want them bragging about it. Steve Crocker, now an IPTO program manager working under Roberts, was glad he wasn't the one overseeing the dance automation project. But he did have a small problem of his own with researchers he was funding at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab. On random unannounced visits, they would show me proudly the lab's quadraphonic simulation of a buzzing fly, which ate up 25% of the computing resources there, Crocker said. One of the first things Lukasik had done upon being named head of the agency was get Roberts to give him an email address and access to the ARPANET. It was unusual for someone who wasn't a computer scientist to be interested in using network mail, and more unusual for anyone to grow as reliant on it as Lukasik did. A frequent flyer, Lukasik seldom boarded a plane without lugging aboard his 30-pound portable Texas Instruments terminal with an acoustic coupler, so he could dial in and check his messages from the road. I really used it to manage ARPA, Lukasik recalled. I would be at a meeting, and every hour I would dial up my mail. I encouraged everybody in sight to use it. He pushed it on all his office directors, and they pushed it on others. ARPA managers noticed that email was the easiest way to communicate with the boss, and the fastest way to get his quick approval on things. Lukasik and Roberts had an excellent relationship, partly because they were both analytical thinkers, and partly because Roberts was always quick to answer any questions Lukasik had about his projects. If we had a meeting on Tuesday afternoon and I sent Larry away with some questions to answer, he'd come back the next day for another meeting with more than just answers. He'd have trends and projections and comparisons. Then Lukasik discovered what was happening, and the utility of email became clearer than ever. Typically, Roberts would leave Lukasik's office, return to his own office, and fire off messages to the experts on the topic at hand, who in turn bounced the questions off their graduate students. 24 hours and a flurry of email later, the problem had usually been solved several times over. The way Larry worked was the quintessential argument in favor of a computer network, Lukasik said. During Lukasik's tenure, Roberts's annual budget nearly doubled, from $27 million to $44 million. In 1973, Lukasik commissioned an ARPA study that found that three-quarters of all traffic on the ARPANET was email. By then, sending email was a simple and nearly trouble-free process. However, trying to read or respond to it was something else. Functional, but not at all easy. Text just poured onto the screen or out of the printer, and nothing separated the messages. To get to the last one, you had to run through them all again. For many users, the only way to read mail was to turn on the teletype and print out streams of text. Composing messages was truly an annoyance, because tools for text editing were primitive. And there was no reply function for email. To respond, you had to start a new message from scratch. Lukasik, who hated throwing anything away, was beginning to get frustrated by the volume of email piling up in his inbox. He went to Roberts. I said, "Larry, this email is great, but it's a mess," Lukasik recalled. In typical Larry fashion, he came in the next day and said, "Steve, I wrote some code for you that may help." And he showed me how to get a menu of messages, or file them, or delete them. Roberts had just written the first mail manager software. Roberts called his program RD for Read. Everyone on the ARPANET loved it, and almost everyone came up with variations to Read, a tweak here and a pinch there. A cascade of new mail handling programs based on the 10X operating system flowed into the network. NRD, WRD, Bananard, banana was programmer slang for cool or hip, HG, MailSys, XMail, and they kept coming. Pretty soon, the network's main operators were beginning to sweat. They were like jugglers who had thrown too much up in the air. They needed more uniformity in these programs. Wasn't anyone paying attention to the standards? For reasons unrelated to email, but apparent to all who use the network daily, occasionally the network simply went berserk. Or as one person said, it became wrinkled. Trouble in one machine could trip a system-wide domino effect. Case in point, the Christmas Day 1973 lockup. The Harvard IMP developed a hardware fault that had the bizarre effect of reading out all zeros into the routing tables, thereby informing other IMPs across the country that Harvard had just become the shortest route, zero hops, to any destination on the ARPANET. The rush of packets toward Harvard was breathtaking. Users would notice a crash like that. Everything came to a halt. "Harvard became a black hole," said John McQuillan, then a Harvard graduate student. "All the traffic went to Harvard, and, like a black hole, no information came out." McQuillan had been introduced to network operations by Ben Barker and had helped connect Harvard's PDP-1. While finishing his doctorate, McQuillan was hired to improve the software for BBN's network control center. On Christmas Day, as the zeros from Harvard were sent to routing tables across the country, even the control traffic used by BBN to diagnose and debug the system got sucked into the gravitational orbit of Harvard's faulty IMP. The BBN operators had to cauterize, cut off that part of the network, debug it, and then bring it back up. Like a utility company, BBN was rapidly developing the means to deal with such occurrences, and there were relatively few network-wide crashes, none lasting very long. On Tuesdays, the days that BBN had the ARPANET reserved for housekeeping chores, McQuillan got in by 6 a.m. Crowther and Walden had stopped programming the IMPs. Between 1972 and 1974, McQuillan picked up primary responsibility for revising the codes and designing the release procedures. He led the team that wrote all the new IMP software and made the releases into the network. He built fairly elaborate test networks in the BBN laboratory, where he simulated failure scenarios, forcing the test network to fail so he could learn to make the ARPANET more fail-safe. "You just know that the computers are going to encounter lightning storms and power failures and software bugs and hardware bugs, and the janitor's going to trip over the power cord, and just anything you can think of could happen," said McQuillan. But of all the potential problems, trouble in the routing algorithm was deemed the worst. For all of its elegance and simplicity, the original routing algorithm written by Crowther was flawed, for although it was lean, in a sense the scheme was too primitive for heavy traffic. It was a known problem, but it didn't matter until the network reached a point when heavy use and a large number of nodes began to strain the routing scheme. "This didn't start to happen until the network got big," said McQuillan. "When it was real small, the basic protocols all worked. But when it's small, almost anything will work." They knew that when the system reached 50 or 60 nodes, the old algorithm wouldn't be able to provide routing updates fast enough, and they'd have a real big mess on their hands. McQuillan made it his mission to completely bulletproof the calculation, so that it would keep working in the face of impossible problems. In 2 years, with a lot of releases, McQuillan replaced the routing algorithms, the way acknowledgments worked, and eventually the whole IMP operating program. He built a completely different algorithm for flooding information about changes in the network very quickly to all the IMPs, so they wouldn't make bad routing decisions. And he eliminated deadlock scenarios, partly by eliminating the infamous roughnums from the equation. "I knew all the computers on the network," McQuillan said, "and I knew where they were and what their numbers were and who was there, and I knew them all by name." By now, there were nearly 50 IMPs on the ARPANET. Something about a mail system, digital or otherwise, is inviting to those with a certain nonconformist temperament. Perhaps because there must be rules, some people will always try bending them. There was the clever fellow, for instance, who got away with using the U.S. Postal Service to mail bricks, one by one, to Alaska, until he had enough there to build himself a house. It was the cheapest way to ship them from the lower 48 states. Or there's Auntie M., who embellishes her packages to her far-flung nieces and nephews with fanciful illustrations, to the probable amusement rather than consternation of the postal clerks. Somewhere in a thick book of fine print are the official postal regulations regarding U.S. mail, what can be sent, what can't, and how. But within limits, all manner of packages get delivered, because human mail clerks can adjust to a fairly wide latitude of nonconformity. But imagine a local post office somewhere that decided to go it alone, making up its own rules for addressing, packaging, stamping, and sorting mail. Imagine if that rogue post office decided to invent its own set of zip codes. Imagine any number of post offices taking it upon themselves to invent new rules. Imagine widespread confusion. Mail handling begs for a certain amount of conformity, and because computers are less fault-tolerant than human beings, email begs loudly. The early wrangling on the ARPANET over attempts to impose standard message headers was typical of other debates over computer industry standards that came later. But because the struggle over email standards was one of the first sources of real tension in the community, it stood out. In 1973, an ad hoc committee led by MIT's Bhushan tried bringing some order to the implementation of new email programs. Everyone knew that in the long run, a separate mail transmission protocol, independent of the FTP, was needed. Network mail was taking on a life of its own. It had its own technical problems, and it couldn't stay glued to FTP forever. But for now, just standardizing mail headers was enough of a headache. Data packets on the ARPANET already had something called headers, but they were entirely different from email headers. The headers on data packets were coded bits read strictly by the IMPs, telling them how to handle each packet as it came along. In the context of electronic mail, however, the header refers to a larger raft of information at the top of every email message. The idea was that certain information should always appear at the top of messages in a specified format, really just an elaborate time and date locator, including information such as the time a message was sent and delivered, the route it traveled, other recipients to whom it was sent, and more. Bhushan's committee also suggested a syntax that would make it easier to read headers without the aid of a lot of special message processing. Headers weren't always something seen only by the user. Some header fields were processed by receiving systems, programmed to deal with reserved meanings and very tightly defined syntax. If the recipient program somehow misinterpreted the sender's header, the results could be exceedingly frustrating. The reader program might stop dead in its tracks or spit out an error message. Dates, for example, were specified in a particular way, and deviations might be unintelligible. Or if you put a comma in the wrong place, your mail program's ability to process messages might go awry. When one mail handler couldn't parse headers sent by others, it was as if a postal clerk in Kenosha, Wisconsin, were being asked to deliver letters addressed in Sanskrit and Arabic. Machines on the ARPANET encountered computer language barriers of this kind regularly, and the problems multiplied with the growth in both the number of mail programs and the number of nodes on the net. Depending on the kind of mail system one might use to send a message, an incompatible program or operating system at the receiving end would barf up the headers, as one observer put it. If the message got through, the person who received it still might have to deal with a garbled translation or screwed-up formatting. Recipients would complain about the sender. A sender might agree to fix the problem with a hack or kludge. A kludge is a crock that works, went one definition, if he had the time. Or if he liked his own mail program well enough, he might simply complain about the recipients. Setting up an email exchange was like asking someone out on a date. Email was seen as something between consenting adults, said Brian Reed, a computer scientist who was working on his Ph.D. at Carnegie Mellon. A certain mature understanding was required. "I have an email program. I want to send you mail, and you want to receive it," he continued. "And as long as we agree on the standard, it's fine." Many users of early fax machines went through the same kind of rigmarole, making sure the sender's machine could communicate with the recipient's fax machine. The problem occurred on a massive scale between 10x and non-10x machines. Programmers at a few non-10x sites, like those working with machines based on the Multics operating system, continued introducing email programs and features in the syntax of their own operating systems, and continued sending their messages out over the net. 10x machines, however, couldn't handle the syntax of other formats used at some sites, so again, conflict and confusion would result. The diversity of non-standard systems on the net caused problems even with something as apparently trivial as Tomlinson's at sign. The at sign dispute was long-running, and there were many sides to it. There was disagreement over what should go on the left-hand side of the sign and what should go on the right. But before that, there was debate over whether it should even be used at all, as the delimiter between the user and host names in the address. The Multics folks objected vehemently when it was first used, understandably so. Tomlinson, a 10x hacker, had chosen the at sign without realizing, perhaps, that in the Multics system it was the character used to send a line kill command. Any Multics user who tried to send mail to Tomlinson at BBN10X would quickly get into trouble. Multics would start reading the address and counter the at sign and throw away everything on the line that had been typed previously. Ted Meyer and Austin Henderson, from the BBN10X group, decided to try their hand at solving one of these compatibility issues, the header problem. In April 1975, they issued a nude list of standard headers. The document, which they gave the title Message Transmission Protocol, appeared as RFC 680. But RFC 680 immediately created a ruckus among those who thought the effort too 10x-oriented. Postel, keeper of the RFCs, whose quiet word was often final, wielded the gavel. RFC 680, he said, was as standard as mail ever got. "It is nice that many mail-reading programs will accept mail that does not conform to the standard," he said, "but that does not justify mail-sending programs' violation of the standard." "If the standard is inadequate," he added, "any proposals to change it are welcome." The TIFF made clear that 10x sites, led by BBN, formed a dominant culture on the network, while the minority sites, with their diverse operating systems, posed a potentially rebellious counter-movement. Thus were planted the roots of a protracted conflict that continued into the ensuing decade, and became known in the community as the Header Wars. Many of those battles were fought in the arena of a new group of computer conversationalists, the Message Group. On June 7, 1975, Steve Walker, an ARPA program manager at IPTO, drafted a message to announce the formation of something new, an electronic discussion group. "The network community," he wrote, "needs to develop a sense of what is mandatory, what is nice, and what is not desirable in message services. We have had a lot of experience with lots of services and should be able to collect our thoughts on the matter." He welcomed opinions from anyone willing to toss them in, and even provided a bit of ARPA funding to launch it. "This whole thing is a new attempt," he continued. "I hope from all this to develop a long-term strategy for where message services should go on the ARPANET, and indeed in the DoD. Let's have at it." In the truncated verbal style permeating the culture of computing, the Message Services Group was dubbed the MSG Group. Dave Farber at UC Irvine volunteered to be the Message Group file clerk, and Farber volunteered the help of a colleague, a consultant named Einar Steferud. Before long, the bulk of the daily housekeeping chores fell to Steferud, who began in the job by keeping the list of Message Group participants, signing up newcomers, cajoling them into posting introductory biographies of themselves, and sorting out bounced mail. Steferud would become the Message Group's moderator and man behind the curtain. Serving as the go-between, he received messages for posting and manually remailed them to everyone on the list. It was an arduous process that became automated later on. Not everyone conducted his business in the open-air market of the Message Group. There was just as much or more private email traffic among programmers. But everyone in the world involved in implementing mail systems eventually participated, or at least knew what transpired in the group. The discussion was to last 10 years. In time, thousands of messages and hundreds of thousands of words were exchanged by the 100 or so Message Group participants. The Message Group was among the first network mailing lists. There were other mailing lists, most of them unsanctioned, around the educational sites. The first widely popular unofficial list, called SF Lovers, was devoted to science fiction fans. The header wars brought out the stubborn and strong-willed traits of the programmers. Operating conflicts between machines were only the half of it. header troubles were also rooted in human disagreement over how much and what kind of information should be presented at the tops of messages. People differed widely over how much header information they cared to deal with when looking at their mail. Some programmers and mail programs included a lot more in their header fields than others did. They iced the cake with character counts, keywords, and various esoterica. Critics, meanwhile, argued strenuously for economy, opposing an information overload. They saw too many fat and frivolous headers, the electronic equivalent of noting the cotton rag content of a sheet of stationery. Short messages with cumbersome headers always appeared top-heavy, out of balance, emphasizing the header rather than the message. Brian Reed at Carnegie Mellon, who often sounded the voice of reason in the message group, was in the short header camp. "Go ahead and put in 34 different header fields," he said. "All I ever really wanted to look at is from and date." Others agreed. The ideal program would allow users to design their own headers. At least one elaborate mail system, Doug Engelbart's NLS Journal Mail, offered an invisible information feature that allowed selective viewing of a great deal of header data. On May 12, 1977, Ken Pogren, John Vital, Dave Crocker, and Austin Henderson launched a computer mail putsch. They announced at last the completion of a new mail standard, RFC 724, a proposed official standard for the format of ARPA network messages. The standard they were proposing contained more than 20 pages of specifications, syntactical, semantic, and lexical formalities. The RFC explained that the receiver of a message could exercise an extraordinary amount of control over the message's appearance, depending on the capabilities of one's mail reading system. In the days after the publication of RFC 724, the computing community's response was at best cool to the new protocol. Alex McKenzie of BBN was particularly outspoken. Postel, who had been a defender of the old RFC 680, was the least impressed by the new proposal. He came down hard on the assertion that this was to be an official ARPA standard. "To my knowledge, no ARPANET protocol at any level has been stamped as official by ARPA," he said. "Who are the officials anyway? Why should this collection of computer research organizations take orders from anybody?" There was too much emphasis on officialism and not enough on cooperation and perfection of the system. "I prefer to view the situation as a kind of step-by-step evolution," he said, "where documents such as RFCs 561, 680, and 724 record the steps. To make a big point of officialness about one step may make it very hard to take the next step." The RFC 724 team absorbed the criticism. 6 months later, under Dave Crocker's and John Vital's leadership, a final revised edition of RFC 724 was published as RFC 733. This specification was intended strictly as a definition of what was to be passed between ARPANET hosts. They didn't intend to dictate the look and feel of message programs or the features they could support. Less was required than allowed by the standard, they said, so here it was. And there it sat. A number of developers wrote or revised mail programs to conform with the new guidelines, but within a year of RFC 733's publication, the persistent conflict picked up again. Of particular concern, RFC 733 headers were incompatible with a mail program called MSG, in spite of the fact that its author, John Vital, had helped write RFC 733. MSG was far and away the most popular mail program on the ARPANET. A hacker's hacker, Vital had written the MSG program in 1975 out of sheer love for the work. MSG was never formally funded or supported, other than by me in my spare time, he explained. But soon, MSG had a user community of more than 1,000 people, which in those days meant a huge portion of the wired world. Vital had used Roberts's RD mail program, which was great for handling two or three messages at a time, or even a short message stack. But Vital was getting 20 messages a day now and wanted a program to manage them with greater ease. What MSG did was close the loop, he said, so that you could parcel messages out to various other files, called folders, and ultimately answer and forward. Vital, in fact, became widely known for putting the word answer into the lexicon of email. He invented the answer command, which made replying to messages a cinch. Recalled Vital, "I was thinking, hey, with an answer command, I don't have to retype, or mistype, a return address or addresses." An inspiring model, MSG spawned a whole new generation of mail systems, including MH, MM, MS, and a heavily funded, Pentagon-sponsored project at BBN called Hermes.MSG was the original killer app, a software application that took the world by storm. Although there was never anything official about it, MSG clearly had the broadest grassroots support. It was all over the network. Even ARPA's top folks in the Pentagon used it. If anything was the most widely accepted standard, it was MSG, which reigned for a long time. A few people at BBN were still using MSG in the 1990s. Vital's MSG and his answer command made him a legendary figure in email circles. "It was because of Vital that we all assimilated network mail into our spinal cords," recalled Brian Reed. "When I met him years later, I remember being disappointed, as one often is when one meets a living legend, to see that he had two arms and two legs and no rocket pack on his back." More than just a great hack, MSG was the best proof to date that on the ARPANET rules might get made, but they certainly didn't prevail. Proclamations of officialness didn't further the net nearly so much as throwing technology out onto the net to see what worked. And when something worked, it was adopted. The more that people used the ARPANET for email, the more relaxed they became about what they said. There were anti-war messages, and during the height of the Watergate crisis, a student on the ARPANET advocated Nixon's impeachment. Not only was the network expanding, it was opening wider to new uses and creating new connections among people. And that was pure Licklider. One of the most stunning examples of this began with one of the original IMP guys, Will Crowther. A small circle of friends at BBN had gotten hooked on Dungeons & Dragons, an elaborate fantasy role-playing game in which one player invents a setting and populates it with monsters and puzzles, and the other players then make their way through that setting. The entire game exists only on paper and in the minds of the players. Dave Walden got his introduction to the game one night in 1975, when Eric Roberts, a student from a class he was teaching at Harvard, took him to a D&D session. Walden immediately rounded up a group of friends from the ARPANET team for continued sessions. Roberts created the Mirkwood Tales, an elaborate version of Dungeons & Dragons set in J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle-earth. The game stretched on for the better part of a year and was played mostly on Walden's living room floor. One of the regulars was Will Crowther. Where the other dozen players chose names like Xandar, Clarf, or Groan for their characters, Crowther's was simply Willie, a stealthy thief. Crowther was also an ardent cave explorer, and his wife Pat had achieved renown among cavers for having been part of a small group that discovered the first known link between the Mammoth and Flint Ridge Caves in Kentucky. The combined 144-mile system was the longest known cave in the world. Crowther was the cartographer for the Cave Research Foundation. He used his off-hours to plot intricate subterranean maps on a BBN computer. In early 1976, Will and Pat divorced. Looking for something he could do with his two children, he hit upon an idea that united Will the programmer with Willie the imaginary thief, a simplified computer version of Dungeons & Dragons called Adventure. Although the game did not use actual maps of the Kentucky caves, Crowther based the geometry of adventure on stark mental images of those underground chambers. The iron grate through which players passed at the start of the game was modeled on those installed by the Park Service at entrances to the Flint Ridge system. He even included a caving-in joke or two. The Y2 inscribed on a rock at one point in the game is Caver's shorthand for a secondary entrance. Crowther finished the program over the course of 3 or 4 weekends. His kids, ages 7 and 5, loved it, and Crowther began showing it to friends. But the breakup of his marriage had sapped Crowther's spirit, and he never got around to refining the game. Bob Taylor, now director of the Computer Science Lab at Xerox Corporation's Palo Alto Research Center, persuaded first Severo Ornstein, then Will Crowther, to join him. And when Crowther moved to California in 1976, he left the adventure program behind in a file on a BBN computer. Unpolished though the game was, word of adventure had filtered through the network community. A Stanford graduate student named Don Woods heard about adventure from a friend who had run across a copy on the Stanford Medical School computer, and he downloaded the game from there. But Woods had difficulty getting adventure to run at first, and when he did, he found it riddled with bugs. Still, he was hooked. Adventure made users feel like they were interacting more with the computer, said Woods. It seemed to be responding more to what you typed, rather than just making its own moves like a silent opponent. I think this attracted a lot of players who might otherwise have been turned off by the idea of playing against a computer. This was playing with the computer. The game listed Will Crowther as the author, and Woods decided to track down Crowther to get the source code so he could start making repairs to the rudimentary little program. He sent email to every host on the network looking for Crowther, and finally he found him at Park. Crowther happily handed over the code. It took several months to rework, during which the simple program doubled in size. Woods created new obstacles, added a pirate, twisted the mazes further, and added several treasures that required some problem-solving before they were found. When adventure was done, Woods created a guest account on the computer at the Stanford AI lab to let people play, and swarms of guests logged in. Adventure spread like hula hoops, as people sent the program to one another over the network. Because Crowther had written it in Fortran, it could be adapted to many different computers with relative ease. Both Crowther and Woods encouraged programmers to pirate the game and included their email addresses for anyone looking for help installing, playing, or copying the game. People grew bleary-eyed searching for treasure into the small hours of the morning. I've long ago lost count of the programmers who've told me that the experience that got them started using computers was playing adventure, Woods said. The game inspired hundreds of knockoffs, which eventually spawned an entire industry. Adventure demonstrated the appeal of an open networking culture, and the emphasis on openness grew with time. There were few closed doors on the network, and a free spirit prevailed in people's attitudes about who could come and go through them and for what purposes. Anyone trying to restrict the graduate student population from freely using the network would have grossly misunderstood the mindset of the computer science community. The ARPANET was official federal government property, but network mail was being used for all manner of daily conversation. Then in the spring of 1977, Quasar rolled in the door. Its arrival marked the beginning of the first debate over free speech in cyberspace. The controversy centered on an unusual device made by Quasar Industries and blew up into an argument over using the taxpayer-funded ARPANET to speak, in openly critical terms, about a private company. The brainchild of Quasar Industries, the device stood 5 feet 4 inches and weighed 240 pounds. It was called the Domestic Android Robot, a programmable helper that could perform a dozen basic household tasks, such as mopping the floor, mowing the lawn, washing dishes, and serving cocktails. It came equipped with a personality and speech, so that it could interact in any human situation. it could teach the kids French and continue teaching them while they sleep. At the advertised price of $4,000, the thing seemed a steal. Phil Carlton of Carnegie Mellon was the first to alert the message group on May 26, 1977. His site on the ARPANET was heavily involved in exploring artificial intelligence, speech recognition, and related research problems, so he knew a thing or two about robots. The android and its inventor had attracted a fair amount of national press attention, most of it favorable. Quasar's sales pitch had also caught the attention of Consumer Reports, which ran a skeptical item on it in the June issue just out. At first, Quasar seemed nothing but an amusing diversion from the message group's main business. Everyone in the group knew the thing was a hoax, and for a while that seemed enough. But then a sense of civic duty arose. Dave Farber told of being in Boca Raton, Florida, and hearing on the radio that the Dade County Police Department was considering purchasing a Quasar Guard robot for their county jail for $7,000. In March, the Boston Globe ran a story quoting MIT's Marvin Minsky and other skeptical AI experts. But the article took the overall attitude, said a message group member, that it just goes to show you those academicians can't do anything practical, and all you need is some guy working in the back of a garage to put them to shame. The saga left a trail of disbelief in the artificial intelligence research community. Brian Reed and a colleague, Mark Fox, from the Carnegie Mellon Artificial Intelligence Lab, posted an offbeat report to everyone in the message group, giving them a personal account of their inspection of the domestic robot, Sam's struggle gear, at a large department store in downtown Pittsburgh. People in the research community knowing of CMU's pioneering AI work had been calling the lab to ask how it was possible for Quasar's robot to be so much better at speech recognition than anything CMU had produced. Rising to the challenge, a four-member team from CMU had done the fieldwork. "They found a frightening sight," reported Reed and Fox. In the men's department, among the three-piece suits, was a 5-foot-2-inch aerosol can on wheels talking animatedly to a crowd. Electric motors and a system of gears moved the device's arms. The robot seemed conversant on any subject, recognized the physical features of customers, and moved freely in any direction. The crowd was charmed. But the scientists were skeptical. They looked around for some evidence of a remote controller. "Lo and behold, about 10 feet from the robot, standing in the crowd, we found a man in a blue suit with his hand held contemplatively to his mouth, like Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer in the famous Rembrandt painting." Reed and the others watched for a while and noticed that whenever the robot was talking, so was the man in the blue suit, muttering into his hand. The man had a wire dangling suspiciously from his waist. The discussion about the Quasar robot continued on and off for a couple of years, until in early 1979, Einar Steferud, the message group's moderator, and Dave Farber, who had been lurking on the sidelines of the commentary, sent a note of caution to the message group. "We are asking for potential problems," they warned, "when we criticize the Quasar robot." Using U.S. government facilities to cast aspersions on a corporation, they said, could backfire on the ARPA research community. They urged their peers to impose careful self-censorship, to report only facts of technical interest to the community. Not everyone agreed, and with that, the message group got embroiled in a soul-searching exchange. John McCarthy, who worked at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab, was among those most offended by Quasar's claims. He told the group that he would not be deterred by speculation that Quasar might sue. "I think someone seems to be frightened of his shadow," McCarthy said. "It has never been the custom of carnival snake oil salesmen to sue their critics." Minsky and Reed also made it clear that they would tell any reporter who asked that they believed the robot was a joke, and they'd already expressed that opinion to more than a dozen journalists. "I have no fear of being sued," replied Farber. "However, we are using a public vehicle called the ARPANET. We thereby expose ARPA, DOD, and our future access and use of the network to certain dangers when we use that vehicle for potentially libelous material. Farber again urged restraint. Reed chimed in, saying, "The message group is the closest that we have to a nationwide computer science community forum." Reed had begun to notice that the message group was like a social club. They had argued with each other so much that they had become friends. To restrict discussion would be unnatural. Besides, Reed took a more liberal view of free speech, reasoning that the experiment in communications would suffer if topics were restricted. "Until such time as people start suggesting the overthrow of our government," he said, "I don't think any sensible topic should be off limits." Someone suggested attaching a disclaimer to personal communications on the ARPANET so that personal opinions wouldn't be mistaken for official business. Admitted someone else, "Who hasn't used netmail for personal communication? Who hasn't spent time playing some new game over the net? Be honest." The passion in defense of free speech was matched by an equally strong will to self-protection. The way to protect the network itself was not to attract unwanted supervision by the government. After a few days, the argument wore itself out without resolution, and the message group carried on with business as usual. What emerged from the debate was strong evidence that the networking community felt a deep stake in the creation of the net, ARPA funding or no ARPA funding, and was trying jealously to guard its right to determine its future. In a realm where, in a sense, personal identity is defined entirely by the words people choose, free speech seemed second only to concern for the survival of the realm itself. For the first quarter of 1976, traffic reports showed that the volume of ARPANET mail, compared to the volume of regular U.S. mail, was a mere ant trail in the tracks of an elephant herd. MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab, for example, passed some 9,925 messages during the period. By 1996, by comparison, some sites were processing 150,000 email messages every day. MIT was a typical site, and by extrapolation, if one machine processed about 100 pieces of email a day, multiplied by a factor of 98 or so, the number of hosts then on the net, electronic mail didn't yet appear to pose a threat to the U.S. postal system. The post office handled more than 50 billion pieces of first-class mail a year. But email's steep growth curve wasn't going unnoticed. In the private sector, companies were poised for the concept of electronic mail service to take off. The Computer Corporation of America soon began selling one of the first commercially available email software packages, a $40,000 product called Comet, designed for the PDP-11 mini computer. Another program, called Messenger, developed for the IBM 360 and 370 computers, was soon available from a company called Online Software International for $18,000. Costs were heading down, and some analysts projected a devastating impact on the U.S. Postal Service's first-class business. "We are being bypassed technologically," reported an assistant U.S. Postmaster General at the beginning of 1976. The new technology's growth trend and obvious potential were indeed quite dramatic. A few versions of the more sophisticated ARPANET mail programs, such as MSG, Hermes, and SRI's NLS Journal Mail, were coming into the hands of non-researchers. Several large organizations, including the U.S. Geological Survey, Department of Commerce, National Security Agency, and Gulf Oil had all started using email over local area networks. The government was looking closely at the future of email service. A report for the White House Office of Telecommunications Policy by the consulting firm Arthur D. Little estimated that 30% of all first-class mail was likely to be sent electronically within a few years. The Postal Service reacted to that prediction by awarding RCA a $2.2 million contract to evaluate the technical and economic feasibility of providing email service. In its report, RCA argued for adding email to the post office's services. A USPS advisory panel also took a close look. they recommended making a firm and continuing commitment to electronic mail, on a par with NASA's manned space program. Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign used email several times a day in the autumn of 1976. The system they were using was a basic mailbox program, a technology already more than a decade old. But for a political campaign, this was a revolutionary stroke in communications. On that basis, Carter was labeled the computer-driven candidate. By 1979, President Carter was supporting a post office proposal to offer a limited kind of electronic message service to the nation. The hybrid scheme worked more like a telegram service than a state-of-the-art electronic communication system. Messages would be transmitted electronically between post offices overnight, then delivered to recipients' doorsteps the next day. The proposal was remarkable mainly for how cautious it seemed in view of the technological possibilities. Steferud and others in the message group, the community with the most experience with email, immediately saw the flaws in the U.S. Postal Service's plan, which involved converting messages from digital electronic media to paper, and then delivering them by hand as you would ordinary mail. Not only would this approach cost more than email, but it would never be fast enough to compete with email as long as it depended on USPS's traditional foot power for those final steps to the mailbox. Desktop computers will make the perfect mailbox, Steferud predicted, and would bypass the post office entirely. An analogy could be drawn to the once farcical notion of automated garbage collection, which was unthinkable until the invention of the electric pig, the early name given to the in-sink disposal. The key is not in automating the bag-can-truck personal mechanism, Steferud said. It is in bypassing them altogether. The USPS, like AT&T earlier, never really broke free of the mindset guarding its traditional business, probably because both were monopolistic entities. Eventually, the U.S. Justice Department, the FCC, and even the Postal Rate Commission opposed any significant government role in email services, preferring to leave them to the free market. No issue was ever too small for long discussion in the message group. The speed and ease of the medium opened vistas of casual and spontaneous conversation. It was apparent by the end of the decade to people like Licklider and Barron that a revolution they had helped start was now underway. Tomorrow, computer communication systems will be the rule for remote collaboration between authors, wrote Barron and UC Irvine's Dave Farber. The comments appeared in a paper written jointly, using email, with 500 miles between them. It was published electronically in the message group in 1977. They went on, "As computer communication systems become more powerful, more humane, more forgiving, and above all, cheaper, they will become ubiquitous. Automated hotel reservations, credit checking, real-time financial transactions, access to insurance and medical records, general information retrieval, and real-time inventory control in business would all come." In the late 1970s, the Information Processing Techniques Office's final report to ARPA management on the completion of the ARPANET research program concluded similarly. "The largest single surprise of the ARPANET program has been the incredible popularity and success of network mail. There is little doubt that the techniques of network mail developed in connection with the ARPANET program are going to sweep the country and drastically change the techniques used for intercommunication in the public and private sectors." To members of the message group, electronic mail was as engrossing as a diamond held to the light. Message group members probed every detail. They were junkies for the technology. The issue of time and date stamps, for example, was classic. "My boss's boss's boss complains of the ravings of the late-nighters," someone said. "He can tell from the time stamp, and the sender's habits, how seriously to take the message." "Perhaps we should timestamp with the phase of the moon in addition to date and time," said another. Before long, someone wrote an email program that did just that. "I really liked seeing an accurate timestamp," said someone else. It's nice to be able to unravel the sequence of comments received in scrambled order. Some people use it blatantly as a kind of one-upmanship. I work longer hours than you do. Message group members could argue about anything. There were times when you'd swear you had just dropped in on a heated group of lawyers or grammarians or rabbis. Strangers fell casually into the dialogue, or as someone called it, the polylogue. As the regulars became familiar to one another, fast friendships were cemented, sometimes years before people actually met. In many ways, the ARPANET community's basic values were traditional – free speech, equal access, personal privacy. However, email also was uninhibiting, creating reference points entirely its own – a virtual society, with manners, values, and acceptable behaviors. The practice of flaming, for example, strange to the rest of the world. Familiarity in the message group occasionally bred the language of contempt. The first real flaming, a fiery, often abusive form of dialogue, on the ARPANET had flared up in the mid-1970s. The medium engendered rash rejoiners and verbal tussles. Yet heavy flaming was kept relatively in check in the message group, which considered itself civilized. Steferud almost single-handedly and cool-headedly kept the group together when things got particularly raucous and contentious. He slaved to keep the message group functioning, parsing difficult headers when necessary, or smoothing out misunderstandings, making sure the group's mood and its traffic never got too snarly. About the worst he ever said, when beset by technical problems, was that some headers had bad breath. By comparison, there was a discussion group next door, metaphorically speaking, called Header People, reputed to be an inferno. "We normally wear asbestos underwear," said one participant. Based at MIT, Header People had been started by Ken Herrenstein in 1976. The group was unofficial, but more important, it was unmoderated, meaning it had no Steferud-like human filter. Herrenstein had set out to recruit at least one developer from every kind of system on the ARPANET, and in no time the conflicts in Header People raised the debate over headers to a level of a holy war before flaming out.